the 43rd study of the apocalypse, held at the Enfield Appraisal Hall on the 27th of September, 1977, Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, The Judgment on Babylon the Great, and the reading, Revelation, chapter 17.
The Ecclesia of the Living God, brethren and sisters, who have the testimony of Jesus Christ, we come together once again in these last days to consider his word together. Well, let us therefore open our meeting by singing first of all hymn number 141, followed by a word of prayer. Hymn 141. Welcome, of course, brothers and sisters, any visitors which we have among us. We particularly welcome those who are with us this evening from the local ecclesias. We believe that Brother John has some interesting remarks for us now on this week in Israel.
There have been two or three things going on of quite some significant interest over the last week, and it seems that some of the developments which have been planned tentatively planned over the last few months are starting to come to fruition. First of all, however, we've got the situation in Lebanon. That is, in the southern section of Lebanon, where the Israeli armies have been going in and supporting the Christian forces which are there, the phalangist forces as they are styled. Unfortunately, this transparency isn't the best one we've ever had, but we hope that you'll be able to get some sort of a picture from it. And what we're showing here is an enlarged view of the northern section of Israel. Here is the border going across here to what is called Western Galilee, and comes right up into here, with Lebanon, of course, intruding down into here, and Syria coming down over into here. So the border goes along there, but now it goes up there onto the Golan Heights and down here. Now the section where Israel has crossed is just a little north of Metula here, to a place called El Kahan. And just north of there, there was a hill, Tel El, I forget the part that comes after it, and they had actually set up their artillery on this hill, a little bit north of El Kahan, which was about 6 miles inside the Lebanese territory. And on this particular hill, they were able to train their artillery into the area which was inhabited by the Palestinians.
Don't know whether you can pick it up, or you might be able to if you're fairly close to the front. But you see these circles with two little sections blacked out. All of those places are known Palestinian strongholds. And that was the area, you see, where Israel decided to go across the border to take the side of the Christian Falangist group and to oppose the PLO. Well, what has happened is that through the good offices of the United States, a ceasefire has been achieved in the last couple of days in which the PLO and the Israel come Christian parties have agreed to a ceasefire. I think there's probably a little bit more in it than this, and this of course brings us to what is really, I suppose, the most significant of the features at the present time. It seems to me that this has been somewhat of a trade-off as far as the US are concerned, because they've now got Israel to accept for the first time that when the Geneva talks are reconvened, that there could be Palestinian representation. And that means that amongst the Arab delegation that goes there, the Israelis are prepared to speak to Palestinians as part of the Arab delegation. This means they're going to consider the UN Resolution 242, which was the settlement after 1967, which never got put into effect. And although Israel have agreed to accept the Palestinian the Palestinian group as part of the Arab delegation, I don't frankly think that Begin has any intention of weakening his stand whatsoever. And so we turn then to have a look at the situation as it exists between Israel and the United States in particular, because we've reached the stage now where Israel can no longer take for granted the backing of the United States. The United States, through President Carter in particular, are trying to soften Israel's line. Israel, of course, has now got a government which is, shall we say, a harder line than ever before, and so we've got this most unusual set of circumstances. So the Jerusalem Post for this week comments on the fact that as the United Nations General Assembly opens today to an anticipated Arab onslaught on Israel, there has been little of the coordination between the United States and Israel that marked political strategy in past years. Some observers believe that this session may see indirect American pressure on Jerusalem through the agency of an upgraded United Nations. A major factor is still evolving US policy at the United... A major factor in still evolving US policy at the UN will be the results of the talks between Moshe Dayan and the American officials. America's stance will become apparent within the next few weeks as the Arabs prepare to follow up the General Assembly opening with a concerted attack on Israel in major UN forums. Israeli diplomats are particularly concerned over the danger that Washington might join a condemnation of settlement policy in the West Bank. Egypt, in asking for the inclusion of this item on the Assembly agenda, was careful to adhere to the language of positions supported in the past by the United States. President Jimmy Carter has himself used the word illegal in talking of the settlement. And so it goes on to say that possibly for the first time, instead of the United States coming in and with the power of its vote casting a veto, it may just see fit to abstain, in which case the resolution will be passed against Israel. So it's a very intriguing situation. I am rather loath to quote comic strips, but I thought the one on the back was particularly significant, as it did summarise the situation about as good as any. And if you will excuse me quoting this, I can't show you the pictures, but it shows a telephone conversation between Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Yasser Arafat of the PLO. And Sadat is saying to Yasser Arafat, he says, "Look, Carter made his homeland speech, and you turned around and rejected UN Resolution 242. He says, "Now Carter is calling for Palestinian participation in Geneva." So he says, "Now you've got to say something moderate." He's telling Yasser Arafat he's got to be moderate. "He's not going to send you an invitation with a blue ribbon on it." The next thing, the scene changes, you've got a picture of the White House, and you've got Carter calling out to his Secretary of State, Begin. He says, "Begin." He says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Hold your finger here while I tie this bow." So
That's the Israeli view of what America is actually doing for them. They are bending over backwards, apparently, to do everything they can to accommodate the Palestine Liberation Organization. And so it does appear that the thing that we can deduce from this is that more and more Israel is going to become isolated. And yet in so doing, she's taking a harder stand. And so our last item of interest is this comment which says, Ergen men get to top post. Now we realise, don't we, that this new liquid government consists of those people who were the real guerrillas back in 1948. The Ergen movement, who weren't quite as bad as the Stern gang, but they were certainly pretty hard men. And so the cabinet was officially notified last week of the appointment of two comrades of Premier Menachem Begin in the pre-1948 Ergen Ve'Lumi to top government posts. It mentions that one is Yaakov Aknin, but the other one is Amahai Paglin, a manufacturer of ovens, who was appointed the Premier's advisor on the war against Arab terrorism. He was chief operations officer of the IZL. Since 1948, he has not been involved in military or intelligence activity. Paglin, who is 54, was once described by Begin as having military talent bordering on genius. His name was Gidi, G-I-D-I, not the English word, in the Ergen. After Haganah merged with the other undergrounds in 1948 to form the IDF, however, Premier David Ben-Gurion refused to allow Paglin to be inducted. In 1972, he was arrested on suspicion of helping the Jewish Defence League smuggle arms out of Israel abroad to fight Arab terror. He provided the crates from his plant. In 1974, he got a one-year suspended sentence. The JDL chief Rabbi Meir Kahani had organised the smuggling operation after the Munich Olympics massacre of 11 Israel sportsmen. And so these men are now coming to the top post. So the situation as we see it is this. America trying to take a softer line and getting Israel to take a softer line, and the government which is now in taking a harder line than ever. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, if and when, and it does appear that it will happen now, that the Geneva talks are reconvened. Although they've gone along and will accept the Palestine organisation being there, I very much doubt at all whether we'll see any retraction on the part of the Israeli government.
The reading this evening, brethren and sisters, to introduce our talk is taken from Revelation chapter 17, and we'll call upon Brother Graham Travis to read that for us.
Reading together, Revelation chapter 17. And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven horns, and which had the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of the life from the foundation of the world, when they beheld the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads and seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was, and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but received power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and are chosen and are faithful. And he said unto me, The waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God hath put in her heart to fulfill his will, and to agree, and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city, which reigneth over the kings of the earth.
Thank you, Graham. And now, brothers and sisters, we'll all listen attentively as Brother John delivers the address to us to the subject, The Judgment of Babylon the Great.
Dear brethren and sisters, it is my intention, God willing, tonight to complete all of Revelation chapter 17. This shouldn't be really difficult. In fact, I'm anticipating probably finishing with quite a few minutes to spare. So we will suggest then there should be opportunity at the end for questions and perhaps some additional comments from those in the audience. I say that's my intention. You never can quite tell how it's going to end up, but that's the way we're heading. Now, although we did start Revelation chapter 17 last week, we spent most of the night having a look at some slides on Babylon and Rome, and we did go through the early verses. I do want to spend a few moments going briefly over them again, and in fact going over more than just those early verses, but just placing the development of this beast as a means of revision for those who've done it before, and for those who haven't done it, well, we hope it's going to put you in the picture. Now, we're going to project up on the screen that chart which we referred to many times and which we've got in our notes. It's the one entitled The Kingdom of Men, Christadelphian Teaching Since 1848. And this chart, which is essentially based upon the third section of Elpis Israel, shows to us the correlation which exists between the beast of Daniel and the beast of Revelation. So if you can't see the one on the screen, that is the one that is also in the previous set of notes. Just keep flicking the notes, it's a fold-out page, and it'll come out whichever page it's on. Now, what we want to see here is the development of this beast, because tonight, as you noticed in the reading, we read about this rather unusual beast that was, that is not, and yet it is, which, of course, is a conundrum in anybody's language. And what John is going to be telling us is that whilst it was, and whilst it is in a certain sense now, in another sense it isn't. So if we can get a clear picture of the various phases of the development of this beast, that verse becomes totally self-explanatory when we get to it. And I won't have to say anything about it at all, really. Of course I will, but I don't have to. And there will be a lot of other things in the chapter which I think will just fall into place if we get this clear picture. So if we come then to this chart, you remember we had a look at the beast of Daniel. Well, we're only concerned now with Daniel's fourth beast. That's the one in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 6. This dreadful and terrible fourth beast, that's how Daniel describes it, was so dreadful and so terrible that he couldn't find a name for it. Now, the beast of Daniel chapter 7 then is a general picture of the whole of the history of the Roman Empire.
It goes from the very earliest stages of the development of the Roman Empire right through to the time when it will be destroyed, because it is the fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 whose body is given to the burning flame. So as far as Daniel is concerned, he sees this one beast as representing the whole history of the Roman Empire. At one stage there were several horns come up. There was the three horns which were uprooted by another little horn, and he saw various changes to this one beast. When we come to Revelation though, instead of seeing changes to one beast, we see various types of beasts which represent the same thing as Daniel saw, except in more detail. And so our dragon of Revelation chapter 12, our beast of the sea of Revelation 13 verses 1 to 10, our beast of the earth of Revelation 13 verses 11 to 18, and now tonight the beast with the woman sitting on it of Revelation chapter 17, show to us 1, 2, 3, 4 stages answering in fact to the one beast of Daniel chapter 7. John, however, splits it up into 4 different beasts. Alright, briefly revising, we see that Revelation chapter 12 spoke of the history of the Roman Empire during that period when we would style it the pagan Roman Empire. Now, pagan Rome simply refers to the Roman Empire before it became Christian. And it became Christian at about 300 AD. We usually specify it as 312 AD. 312 is the period which we usually designate as the time when Constantine made pagan Rome Christian or Catholic Rome. So prior to that time, it was all pagan, back to its earliest days. When we come to Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 to 10, we are now introduced to the beast. Now, the dragon of chapter 12 was called a dragon. The beast first appears in Revelation 13, although the word itself does appear in Revelation chapter 11. But the beast then of the sea represents the stage of Roman history which went from the time of Constantine, essentially, through to about 800 AD. It's styled the beast of the sea, Rome in development, 493 specifically, to 800 AD, showing the eclipse of the imperial system and rejuvenation in the Justinian epoch, giving papal privileges. We're not going to go over all the details of that, but that's the beast of the sea. When we come to Revelation 13 verses 11 to 18, we now come to another beast, which in fact historically is the next stage of the Roman Empire, and that's called the beast of the earth. It's a beast that looks like a lamb, but it spoke like a lion. It's styled the beast of the earth as opposed to the beast of the sea of the earlier verses. And this refers to the development of the Holy Roman Empire, which really had its foundation around about 800 AD. The foundation was laid for the Roman Empire at the time when Charlemagne was crowned emperor. And the Holy Roman Empire lasted till when? Any suggestion whether, just as a bit of a test, when did the Holy Roman Empire fall, or has it fallen? Just roughly, I'll give you plus or minus 3 years. That's about plus or minus 10 years, so you're in the paddock. If you come to somewhere just over the 1800 mark, around about 1800 and... Well, I say plus or minus 3 years, because if I say 4, I think Arthur's going to say 5, and we had a bit of a disagreement on exactly the year when it fell. But it was somewhere around about the... It was in the period of Napoleon, remember? And depending on whose history book you take as to whether it's 1800, 3, 4, 5, but around there. So the Holy Roman Empire then fell at the turn of the 1800 period, when Napoleon overthrew the Emperor of Austria, who was the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So what we've got left then after this is simply papal Rome. Now that's going to bring us down then to this beast of Revelation chapter 17. When you look at Revelation 17 and Revelation 18, it almost appears on the surface as though there's just a repetition of the judgments on this system.
But if we were to say in its simplest form, what is the difference between Revelation 17, which we've read tonight, and Revelation 18, which God willing will do next class, it is this. That Revelation chapter 17 speaks of the pre-adventual judgment of Rome, and Revelation chapter 18 speaks of the post-adventual whatever the word was of Rome that I used in the first sentence, destruction of Rome, I think was the word. Alright, so although we've got the Lamb referred to in Revelation 17, and it speaks of the fact that the Lamb will ultimately judge the system, most of what Revelation 17 is all about, in fact we're going to say for the sake of argument, all of Revelation 17 in fact refers to what is going to happen to this papal system prior to the advent of the Lord. And chapter 18, on the other hand, goes on to speak about what will happen after the advent of the Lord Jesus Christ. So then this verse of Revelation chapter 17 in fact speaks about the papal system, which is in a sense a carryover of the Holy Roman Empire, but of course it's lost all its power, and yet it gets it back again. It gets it back again in the time of the end. And that's why we're going to see in this study of Revelation chapter 17 this evening, the combination between the horns and the beast. Alright, well I think that might do by way of introduction. There's a few more things I want to say, but I think we'll say those as we actually go through the study. We'll leave the picture up there. I don't think it's doing anybody any harm. Is that fan affecting you, Harold? No? Alright, we'll leave it on there. Well, coming then to Revelation chapter 17, and you may like to have your notes open in front of you, because most of the comments I will make will be found there anyway, so if you didn't understand something I said, just glance down at the notes and you'll probably find them there. Now, in chapter 17, we're introduced in the opening verses to this woman. We commented on that last week, and we won't go into it in the same detail this week. The woman represents a religious system. In the first instance, this woman was designed to be the chaste virgin under Christ. But as a result of her committing fornication with the kings of the earth, and she was found to be with child, in the first instance of Revelation chapter 12, this happened at the time that brought about the birth of Constantine, so we've got now an adulterous woman symbolically representing that apostate church system. So the woman of the book of Revelation is either the chaste virgin under Christ, or it is the adulterous woman who represents the apostate church, the true ecclesia as against the apostate church. Well, there's no doubting what it is in this case. It's the apostate church. Now the apostate church system then is described as this great whore that sitteth upon many waters. So she's a powerful woman now. She's a powerful church because she controls many waters. Verse 15 says, "And the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." There's one of those very beautiful little verses which immediately gives you the solution. And there are just sufficient of these in the apocalypse to be able to help us interpret what's going on. So then here is a church system which controls many nations, but still a church system. So the woman then represents the church system. But of course, the woman is riding on the beast. And that's why we had to go through that little bit about the beast, because the woman and the beast, although two separate identities, are in fact seen as a unit. It's like the chariot and the rider in it. And so here is the woman riding upon the beast. We're told what her designation is in verse 2, that having committed fornication with the kings of the earth, she therefore is this apostate church system. Now, we read that he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. If you've been reading through the notes, you may have wondered how it is that we can connect this wilderness of Revelation 17 verse 3 with the wilderness of the people of Ezekiel chapter 20 and of Isaiah chapter 35. Just reading through the note as it is there, and in reading it through myself again over the last few days, I thought, well, that note doesn't sound very convincing in itself, although I'm convinced that it is quite correct. So I'm going to say a little bit about that. First of all, let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 20 and Isaiah 35, just to see what the prophets say there. In Ezekiel chapter 20, we're dealing not with the subject of Rome, but we're dealing with the subject of the latter day regathering of Israel. Now in Ezekiel chapter 20, and at verse 33, we read there that, "As I live, saith Adonai Yahweh, surely with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out will I rule over you." Now, note the terms there. You know, he's going to bring Israel out of the wilderness of the people and he's going to save them. But he says, "I'm doing it with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out." That's his attitude towards them. "And I will bring you out from the people and will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered with a mighty hand and with a stretched out arm and with fury poured out." So in case we missed it the first time, it is repeated for emphasis. "And I will bring you into the wilderness of the people, and there will I plead with you face to face, like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness of the land of Egypt. So will I plead with you, saith Adonai Yahweh." And so he brings them out into the wilderness of the people. He causes them to pass under the rod. He brings them into the bond of the covenant, and he purges out the rebels. Now, usually when we study Ezekiel chapter 20, we study it from the angle of what effect this is going to have on Israel. And in so doing, we just say the wilderness of the people, well, that's the wilderness of the people. Some say it's Europe, and we often say, well, I wonder why they say it's Europe. And then we get on to its effect on Israel. Well, tonight we're looking at the other side of the story. We're looking at the wilderness of the people itself. Well, the wilderness of the people is that which is described here in Revelation chapter 17. It is the territory of the beast. And that is why, if you read, for example, The Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained by the Doctor, he will talk about the wilderness of the people as the territory of the beast. And like so many of the Doctor's statements, you wonder why he makes that statement, and I often did, until you come to study Revelation and you immediately see the connection, because he doesn't always tell you all of the quotes which go to make up his line of reasoning. So then, we can rest assured then that the territory into which Israel is to be regathered after the return of Christ, in order that Israel might be purged, will be the territory of the beast. And so, as we often say, it will not only involve the purging out of the rebels in Israel, but it will also inflict judgment on those nations which consist of those which make up the territory of the beast. As Brother Thomas says in The Mystery of the Covenant, the condition of Israel in the wilderness of the people is described in Isaiah chapter 35. And whilst we won't read all of that chapter, it is interesting to note that the opening of that chapter starts off with the words that the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. And so whilst initially the territory of the wilderness of the people, which is the territory of the beast, which in general terms is Catholic Europe, whilst initially it will be the scene of judgment, both for the purging of Israel and the judgment of the Roman beast, at the same time the ultimate result will be that it will bring joy and gladness to that area. Why is it styled the wilderness? Well, it's styled the wilderness quite simply because a wilderness is a place where there is no water. And consequently, that chapter in Isaiah 35 goes on to speak about the way in which the water of life will be brought into the wilderness of the people, and the ultimate result will be verse 10, "And the ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." And so inasmuch then as we know that Isaiah 35 and Ezekiel 20 are speaking of the latter days, and Revelation 17 is speaking of the latter days, therefore the wilderness is one and the same place. So John was carried away in spirit into the wilderness, and he saw a woman sit upon a scarlet coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And therefore the territory of the beast, or the wilderness of the people, or Europe as we know it today, is the territory upon which John sees in vision this woman enthroned upon this beast. In verses 4 to 6 of the chapter, we're told that she has a name written, which is Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And it was at this point last week that we sort of terminated our discussion. We should, of course, go back to 2 Thessalonians to see the connection. Back in the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, The Apostle Paul spoke of the day when this system would be developed. And so John now, in vision, looking forward, sees it fully developed. In vision, of course, only, because it wasn't fully developed in his day. Second of Thessalonians chapter 2. Verse 3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Remember ye not that when I was yet with you I told you these things? And now ye know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work. Only he who now hindereth will hinder until he be taken out of the way. So Paul could say then that the mystery of iniquity was already working. Now how could he say that? Well, on exactly the same basis as we saw in Revelation chapter 12, that woman who represented the true ecclesia, was first formed. When was the woman first formed, the true ecclesia? AD 33 at Pentecost, right. And from that very day, the mystery of iniquity was beginning to work. So that 280 day years, the period of gestation of a child, 280 years later, she could bring forth that man of sin, which Paul speaks about here. So that in the year 312 AD, Constantine comes forward as the man-child of sin, and he pronounces pagan Rome now to be Catholic Rome. And so the mystery of iniquity was already working. It was there in its embryo stage. Conception had taken place in AD 33. In the very year that the ecclesia was formed, there were the seeds of error. And Paul could see them developing in his time, and they came to the birth at the time of Constantine. So Constantine then established a religious system and a political system as well to go with it. He took the religious system which had now developed, and he married it to a political system, and of course that became Catholic Rome. So Paul could then say, the mystery of iniquity doth already work. John, looking forward to the time now in which we are living, can see it fully developed. And whilst we can't see it completely fully developed, it's on the eve of being totally fully developed when Europe is finally combined together, as we'll see in a few minutes' time from Revelation 17. The only other thing was, you noticed I changed some words in verse 7 there. For those who aren't familiar with it, the word letteth is an old English word which really means to hinder. It's rather strange, isn't it, because we talk about letting as allowing, whereas in fact it was quite correct back in the days of the King James translators to talk about letting meaning hindering. So he says, only he who now hindereth will hinder until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. And so there was a necessity that the pagan Roman system had to be changed. And it wasn't until pagan Rome could be got out of the way and Catholic Rome or Christian Rome established that this man, of course, could be fully revealed. And so there had to be a change. There were certain things which were hindering the development of this, and of course paganism was the essential feature as far as the Roman Empire was concerned. But our main reason for looking at this was, of course, the term the mystery of iniquity. So when we go back then to Revelation chapter 17, we've got this woman now in her full glory, and upon her head there was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And we are reminded here that it is not just the harlot system itself, but that she is the mother of other systems who are her daughters, and that those systems which would call themselves Protestant have long since forgotten what they ever were protesting about, and they are now doing everything they possibly can to become reunited to the mother. And so we see such developments as the Uniting Church, the Anglican Church and others, all talking in terms of, well, you know, we've got to see how we can accommodate this system. And no longer is there that animosity against the mother. They are returning home. Well, we come then to the section which will take up the most of our time, and that's the section which goes from verses 7 to 11. If you happen to have read the notes in verses 7 to 11, you'll find that they're not well written, in the sense that in order to explain verses 7 and 8, I had to jump across to verse 10, and I think it would have been better if I'd have taken verses 7 to 11 in one lump sum. So what I'm saying is, when you read the notes about verses 7 and 8 and verses 9 to 11, I'd suggest you read them right through in one section, because in order to understand verse 7, you've got to jump to verse 10. So I ended up explaining verse 10 under verse 7, and then when we came to verse 10, well, it had already been explained under verse 7. So if you happen to read this as a set of notes where you want to find out what verse 10's about, and you look under verses 9 to 11, well, in fact, the explanation is really under verses 7 and 8. So if you can simply understand, I'm saying that I should have set it out with verses 7 to 11 in one block, and then I hope it will read a little bit better. Because, in fact, this is one of the most difficult sections we've got to read because of this conundrum, the beast that was, that is, and yet is not. Or the beast that was and is not yet is, I should say. Don't want to make it any harder than what it is. Well, we come then to verse 7. We see then that the beast carries the woman. So the angel said to me, in the words of Brother Thomas, "Wherefore didst thou wonder? I will explain to thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, having the seven heads and the ten horns." So we're reminded then that this beast is the beast with the seven heads and the ten horns. This takes us back then to, right back to the beast of the sea here in Revelation chapter 13. The seven heads and the ten horns. Now can we remember, I don't want you to call out, just to test yourself, can we remember what the seven heads represent? The seven heads represent seven forms of government. Won't ask you what they were, but they're listed in the notes. And then the ten horns represent the later stage when the ten, shall we say, tribes out of Europe came down and absorbed the Roman Empire and took it back, and it made it Europe. And that became known as the Gothic stage, because the Goths were one of the ten groups, in fact probably one of the most powerful of the groups, so that kingdom came to be known as the Gothic kingdom. So we've got then the seven heads and the ten horns. Now we've got to note the difference here. The seven heads were seven forms of government which covered a wide period of Roman history. Well, what was the first form of government? We don't usually call it imperial, but it, in a sense it was. It was something even more so than that. It was back in the time when they had the kings as against the emperors. The earliest form was when they had kings. It goes back almost to prehistory. So we usually call it what do the notes call it? Regal, yes. It was the kingly type. It was somewhat related to imperial, but just a little bit more so. A king was a bit more than an emperor, wasn't it? Although the emperors became, set up a hereditary line, and they were in effect kings. But it's Brother Thomas anyway styles it regal. Now when the kings fell, Rome became a republic, and the republic went through various phases. There was regal, don't know how good I am, I should look up the notes. Regal consular was the dictator's the next one. Dictatorial. Decemviral, which we never did find out exactly what that meant, except the word ten is in there somewhere. So there was first of all the kings, then the consuls, then the dictators, then this decemviral stage, and then tribunicial, when we came to the tribune. Right, that was the fifth one. Now, the sixth stage was the most glorious stage of Roman history, which was when they established their emperors. So around the time of the Caesars. So now, to get things in historical settings, you can forget all the earlier ones because they go back in a very murky, dim sort of period when we don't know a lot about it. You come to the period of the Caesars, you know, a bit before the time of Christ. take the first century BC through to the early centuries AD. Now that's Imperial Rome. That's the period when John's living. Which head is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6th head. Alright? That's the 6th head. And just come down for a moment to verse 9. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains where the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings. Now, Brother Thomas more correctly translates that as there are also 7 governments. There are 7 forms of government. 5 have fallen. Regal, consular, dictatorial, decemviral, tribunicial. They've all fallen. One is Imperial Rome, and the other is not yet come. Now, the one that was yet to come was when the Roman Empire as an empire fell, and it was replaced by the last form of Roman power, which was the Gothic, or in other words, when those 10 powers came down.